This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 15th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 374. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the Big Deal feature. The Free Press editor Barry Weiss called it one of the most important pieces we've run in 2024. Terry Glavin joins me from Vancouver Island to discuss his commentary for the Free Press, the explosion of Jew hate in Trudeau's Canada. The National Post columnist and Real Story Substack publisher also ponders the future of Syria after the fall of the Assad regime and the imminent release of the final report of the Hogue Commission on Foreign Interference. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. And we're approaching the end of the year, and thought it'd be a good time to talk to Terry Glavin from the National Post. He does a Substack newsletter, The Real Story, and his latest is for the Free Press. It's under the headline, The Explosion of Jew Hate in Trudeau's Canada. There has been a 670% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in the past year. Quote, it was like a dam burst, end quote. Barry Weiss, who is the editor of the Free Press and who's become quite a force on the media landscape in the past few years, and she's also host of the Honestly podcast, tweeted this about Terry's story. This is one of the most important pieces we've run in 2024. What's happened to Jews under Justin Trudeau in Canada is shocking. Why did it happen and how? So to answer that is Terry Glavin, who wrote the piece, who introduced an American audience to the Canadian anti-Semitism epidemic. This really was a comprehensive analysis of everything that's happened this year, and you've introduced the American audience to things that have happened right here in British Columbia, right in our backyard, including Samidoun and Selena Robinson. Selena Robinson, the former NDP cabinet minister. Samidoun led a campaign to cancel her, to get her dumped from cabinet back early in the year. And by fall, though, Samidoun was finally declared a terrorist group by both Canada and the U.S.
The funny thing is, you know, Bob, it was 6,200 words. And this, I just sort of brushed past the Samidoun stuff. I mean, that is a really, really big story, obviously. I mean, and I've been covering it from the very beginning. And I think we kind of got the story wrong in one way. Well, I think what really went on there is the U.S. Justice Department said to Canada, look, you know, we can play it your way if you want. You know, Samidoun is a listed terrorist organization in Israel. They're banned from Europe. They're a terrorist organization in Germany and I think the Netherlands. They are a registered nonprofit organization in Canada. Now, do you want the U.S. Justice Department and the U.S. Treasury Department to list a federally registered Canadian not-for-profit corporation as a terrorist organization? Would you like us to do that? That would be pretty embarrassing. It would be pretty historic. And so Canada kind of came on board, and they kind of, you know, diplomacy and all that, they announced that it was kind of a joint deal. But curiously, Khaled Barakat, who is the primary link between the senior command of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, terrorist organization, and Samidoun and Massar Babil and other organizations, he was listed as a foreign terrorist in that decision by the U.S. Treasury Department. He's not mentioned by Canada. So it was all very odd. And the Samidoun story has been quite odd from the very beginning. But it is only one time, believe it or not, it's really tragic to say, it's only one tiny piece of this larger puzzle of how it came to pass that that Canada's Jews have become so disconsolate and isolated and lonely and at a loss. It's Everybody I talked to, I did 16 in-depth interviews, probably another 16 more casual interviews, a lot of research. And this is something that hasn't happened in generations. It is, you know, nobody wants to go there. Nobody wants to say this is just like the 30s. But there's never been a time in Canadian history since the 1930s when you have Jewish institutions attacked, Jewish synagogues firebombed, Jewish places of business, you know, windows broken. And, you know, it's all very well and good to say, well, you know, it's just what's happening in the Middle East and all that sort of thing. But this, these lurid and macabre demands for the destruction of the state of Israel preceded last October. And immediately, I mean, the morning after October 7th, 2023, right across the country, before Israel had moved in, before any of that horrible carnage in Gaza had begun to unfold, you had this screaming, howling mobs of people vowing their support for Hamas and Hezbollah, celebrating the event, the atrocities of October 7th as a legitimate act of resistance. And it got worse from there. So, yeah, I think this is a phenomenon worth paying pretty close attention to.
Yeah, we've seen over the last year and a bit scenes that we thought were relegated to history books, the black and white pictures of the history books in the 1930s and 1940s, but they've come alive in color and moving form in our own communities, and it doesn't look like it's going to stop anytime soon.
Yeah, I think one of the ways we put it in the piece was that, you know, Jews have looked around and they're not just wondering what is torn at the fabric of Canadian society. They're looking at what has been woven very deeply into the fabric of Canadian society, certainly the Canadian political class. I think what the polls will show you is that most Canadians are not anti-Semites. Most Canadians have fairly healthy attitudes about Israel. You know, might not like Bibi very much, very, very upset about what's happening in Gaza, but they're not anti-Semites. They're not anti-Zionists. It's almost impossible to be an anti-Zionist if you embrace just the basic fundamentals of the way Canadians have seen themselves in the world. We were there at the UN. At Israel's creation. We've always argued for a two-state solution. That's all that Zionism is, by the way. It's the national liberation movement of the Jewish people. It's the right of the state of Israel to exist. That's all it is. But it's a very, very, very difficult line to walk, and I hope we did it fairly and well. There is a radical collapse of Canada's immigration system. The consensus on immigration in Canada across the parties that existed for years has completely broken. You've got 1.8 million Muslims in Canada, only a minority of whom were born here. A lot of those people come from countries, Arab countries primarily, where anti-Semitism is deeply embedded in the culture, and anti-Israel sentiment is a central feature of their political culture. That has to be acknowledged. But at the same time, and this is where I think it's far more worrisome, is that most of the, if you like, the discourse on the issue of Israel and the The way there's no distinction left anymore between animus towards Israel and animus towards Jews is largely a function of well-to-do white university students and professors. It's a function of the faculty lounges. It's a function of high society distaste for Jewish culture, Jewish traditions, for Zionist traditions, and so on. And it goes right well into the federal bureaucracy. It's at all levels of government in Canada. It's in the public sector unions. And, you know, I've been writing about this for a while. I started writing about this in earnest about, it's got to be 20 years ago now. And noticed how the so-called anti-war movement, you know, the sort of the main iterations of left-wing politics had kind of shifted from through the 90s after the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was kind of a drift, and then you had 9/11, and then after 9/11, which I think was kind of a blunt trauma wound to everybody's heads, made everybody want to go a little crazy. The main iteration of left-wing politics had gone from anti-globalization. You know, it's funny how the sort of right wing has adopted that position. It had gone from globalization to anti-war polemics, or it described itself as anti-war. Completely ignoring, you know, what the people of Afghanistan might have had to say about it, or the people of Iraq, or the people of Syria. And it was profoundly anti-Zionist and anti-Israel from the very, very, very beginning. So, you know, you've had this kind of build up and entrench itself, particularly in Canada. Canada's a very sort of special case. Some of it has got to do with European influences and British influences, the kind of radical chic, you know, association with the, you know, with Palestinian terrorism, Black September, the PFLP, all that stuff. And also the idea of Zionism as racism, which you know, emerged from the Durban Conference. It was a UN, you know, with the rise of the police state bloc in the United Nations and the organization of Islamic cooperation with the UN. The way Erwin Kotler put it to me, our former justice minister, the other day, is, you know, the UN and its principles are kind of embedded in Canadian DNA. And internationally, you know, the Canadian foreign policy has always at least purported to be based on international norms and human rights. And that whole phenomenon in recent years has been taken over by the Islamic bloc and by this police state bloc at the UN. In Toronto, you had Israel Apartheid Week. The first Israel Apartheid Week of anywhere in the world went on to 60 cities around the world. You had the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, even before the Palestinians, you know, came up with this resolution for boycott. There was one in Toronto. The movement, it actually preceded that in Toronto, and it was the United Church that started it, basically. So, you know, you had that normalization, I think, is the thing to keep your eye on. You had this weird left-wing anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, which, you know, you can trace all the way back to the Soviet era and so on. And then you had Islamist anti-Zionism, which was significantly informed by the Third Reich in the 1930s through the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and so on. And there was a kind of a melding of these two phenomena, and then what's happened over the last 25 years, I think, is the normalization, the cultural and political normalization of a fairly psychotic antipathy to the very idea of Israel's existence. The depiction and understanding of Israel as the embodiment and the epitome of racism, colonialism, apartheid, the patriarchy, all the things that we're supposed to imagine as being really bad things. And then, you blend that with this new construct of settler colonialism, and which completely renders Canada, the United States, Australia, and particularly Israel, irredeemably illegitimate. And you basically get Kristallnacht.
Now, October 7th, of course, has cost a lot of innocent lives, the people in Gaza who were used basically as human shields by Hamas. But there also has been the cost that these terrorist groups have paid themselves and their leadership. Hamas, Hezbollah, the Iranian government, they've lost leaders in this. And of course, the latest domino to fall, Syria, the biggest domino to fall, really, in the region. And in your Substack, the real story. You had your reaction to the fall of the Assad regime under the headline, "The Syrian Revolution Victorious at Last, a Decade Overdue." Of course, the big question is what comes next? And of course, you also say that it's time for the Syrian people around the world to rejoice that the end of the dictatorship has finally come after all these decades. But the big question is, what is next? And who will fill the vacuum?
Yeah, that's the big question, and I think the question has already been largely answered. And it's not particularly happy making. It'll be mainly Turkey. The big winner in this is Turkey. And in fact, Erdogan and his proxy in Syria, the Syrian National Army, has essentially facilitated the rise of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. This is the organization that was kind of the militant front, was the tip of the spear that overthrew Assad. It's like a series of dominoes that were falling. Israel completely eviscerated Hamas, which was an Iranian proxy, the Iranian proxy primarily in Gaza, and also decapitated Hezbollah and getting rid of Hassan Nasrallah. I mean, that's like he was like Gamal Abdel Nasser, I mean, as a personality in the greater Middle East. Getting rid of, I mean, completely decapitating Hezbollah, which was essentially the Praetorian Guard of the Assad regime, backed by Russia and Iran in Syria. So the Israelis also bloodied the Iranians. You remember the Iranians launched their missiles at Israel in a first ever direct attack, and an unfortunate person in the West Bank was killed. That was it. The Israelis, with that amazing walkie-talkie, exploding walkie-talkie operation, and then eliminating Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, and then its destruction of some fairly serious Iranian defensive hardware in its pinpoint strikes there. The writing was on the wall. And so there was this sort of, okay, now's our chance. Jalani and his crew up in Idlib with the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. With Turkey's, Turkey was like surprised by this, but okay, go ahead, right? Give it a shot. And, Homs fell, Hama fell, and then the neck and Aleppo, my gosh, they just walked into Aleppo. And it was just a house of cards. It was a hollow shell. And all the Syrians I know are beside themselves with joy. And I gotta say, I kind of am too. I don't wet my trousers about HDS. Oh, you know, Jawlani used to be with Al Qaeda and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, he was a 20-year-old kid who got really worked up. He went to Iraq, ends up getting picked up almost right away. He's in Camp Buka in prison for about 5 years. He's really, really charismatic, really smart. You know, Zawahiri and all the ISIS guys and, you know, the former Al-Qaeda guys are trying to recruit him. They say, go to Syria, set up a franchise. And right away, he says, you know, I'm not into that kind of crap. I want to get rid of Assad and I want to fight ISIS. And I remember, you know, I mean, I've been quite intimately involved or, you know, watching this story fairly closely for a while. I was with the Kurds filing to the Wall Street Journal. I was in northern Iraq during the Yazidi pogrom. I was, you know, went to every single almost Syrian refugee camp in Jordan, met with the Free Syrian Army underground in Amman, with the Syrian coalition of opposition forces in Ankara, pardon me, in Istanbul. And we could have been, by we, I mean the West, right? It could have been our guys. It could have been the Free Syrian Army, the Democrats, the majority of Syrians, by the way, the most pro-American, pro-Western of all the Arab Spring uprisings. But Barack Obama thought he would be clever. He would say, you know, he wanted his legacy nuclear deal with the Iranians. The Iranians told Bob Kerry, or John Kerry, you know, you leave Assad alone or we'll walk away from the table. So Obama says, okay, and he puts a knife in the back of the Free Syrian Army people, all those young guys, they went and joined Jabhat al-Nusra, which was the predecessor of HTS. And I got to say, and I've said it more than once, I've said it at mosques where I've been asked to speak on the subject, if I was a young guy, 10 years ago in Syria, I would have joined Jabhat al-Nusra, knowing full well it was an Al-Qaeda affiliate. People would gasp. But most the young guys would get it, right? Is that if the Hell's Angels roars into town and they got the guns and they got the money, and they say, okay, please go ahead. You can fight the people who raped your mother and your sister. And you can also fight the people who burned down your school and bombed your village, right? You're going to go with them. And so, you know, all the young guys, there's remnants of the Free Syrian Army still in the north. The American proxy, if it is such a thing, is the Syrian Democratic Forces in the northeast. They're kind of hanging out with the Kurds. Erdogan wants to kill the Kurds. It's a total mess. But for people who say, well, you know, maybe it would be better if Assad was still around, or do you think it could be worse than what went before? I just don't have any time for people like this. It's just not worth having the conversation. This was the bloodiest mass murderer of the 21st century. 500,000 dead. I mean, you know, Sednaya prison being opened up right now. This is like Auschwitz. So yeah, it takes a lot more to make me cry than you know, guys with some dodgy Al-Qaeda background in the leadership of the new government in Damascus. That's where I'm coming from.
And finally, we're near the end of 2024, weeks away from the final report from the Hague Commission on Foreign Interference. Still no official word on the names of the MPs who semi-wittingly or wittingly helped foreign governments. Those were the words in that bombshell report by the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians. And then we got mixed signals from the Trudeau Liberal government. They've ordered TikTok to shut down its Canadian offices, but it won't shut down the TikTok app in Canada. And then, of course, we've got the Trump-Trudeau war of words, trade war of words over the threat of tariffs and Trump wanting better border security, which Canadians have been asking for many years, including at our ports, which are unpoliced. China must be watching with glee as this happens, this rift between Trudeau and Trump happens. And again, I must be watching the mixed signals that the Trudeau government is giving as we're inching our way into 2025, the election year, where Pierre Poilievre and the
Yeah.
Conservatives are expected to come to power, unless, of course, someone brave within the within the Liberal caucus finally forces Trudeau out, or if Trudeau takes, like his father did, a walk in the snow, and considers his future. Where do you think that the Hogue Commission will land? Will it have an impact? Will it cause any change in the way our elections are held? And also, will it make Canada stronger and better protected against foreign interference?
I think there will be certain legislative changes, and we've already seen, some of that. The Foreign Agents Registry, for whatever worth that will be. And I think it's really difficult to say what more we can really reasonably expect from the Hogue inquiry. Because one of the things that I found striking is for most of the evidence and the testimony and the bombshell revelations and the documents that were released, you knew all this stuff. Bob Mackin knew this. I knew this. Sam Cooper knows this. I guess it's reassuring to know that CSIS also knew this. So that's the odd thing. The other is that part of the difficulty, I think, with this story is that it's the way we report and write about it. Foreign interference, for instance. Is it foreign interference if the individuals and the organizations and the networks involved are rooted in a business class, a very wealthy business class that doesn't regard Canadians, its Canadian citizenship or Chinese citizenship, doesn't draw any particular distinction? And is it foreign interference if it's solicited and invited and welcomed? Is that interference? Is that the right word to use? I think this is about, political culture and political values. One thing I've been saying from the beginning about the Trudeau government's intimacies with the United Front, the Chinese overseas operations, influence operations, is that he doesn't see anything wrong with it. I think that's the thing. People are like, God, does the Chinese, what has the Chinese government got on Trudeau? My God, he's doing all this stuff and it's really bad. And they must have some blackmail. He doesn't see anything wrong with it. I think this is the thing to notice. They don't see anything wrong with it. They don't think the way most Canadians do. This is a post-national state. I mean, I don't know how you do national security in a post-national state. What does that look like? So I think it's been very bracing for most Canadians. I think the guys like you, I played a small role, Sam Cooper, Bob Fyfe, Steve Chase. I think that the journalism has made a really big difference. And part of the difficulty too is that there are several significant federal ridings in this country where it is now basically impossible to get elected dog catcher without the say-so of the United Front and its networks. And that's a very real thing. And a lot of damage has been done. There's been a lot of water under the bridge. I don't know. I've been saying, I'm always reluctant to be a kind of a clairvoyant, but I reckon we got about a year, maybe two, before things really start coming unglued. I mean, within the next 12 months, we got 5 million people whose visas expire. Do you think they're just going to say, okay, we're going to go home now? You've got another up to 500,000 people who are undocumented. You've got people who are still coming in. Yo, we've reduced the number of students coming in by 20%. Yay. Okay, fine. You put a little parachute on top of a bus that's gone off the cliff and it's descending into the abyss. All it would take, I mean, these tariffs, if they were to come into effect, all it would take is a slight wobble, another, those tariffs, or maybe another pandemic, And I shudder to think how Polyev imagines that he's going to be able to navigate his way through this. And his policy on housing is like, it's almost an antique. It's like a really cute sort of free enterprise, get rid of the bureaucrats and the red tape, which would have been kind of fun to talk about, 30 years ago. But building more houses is not going to work. They're not going to get built. And those resident, residential construction that does occur will not produce affordable housing. So I wish I could be more cheerful about what I expect, but it's going to be weird. It's going to be weird.
Yeah, well, there'll be nothing but stories to cover, nothing but surprises along the way. For the time being, though, check out Terry's latest for the Free Press, The Explosion of Jew Hate in Trudeau's Canada. It's a long commentary, but vital reading. Great analysis there, as usual, from Terry, who also writes for the National Post. And of course, Terry's got his own Substack. Look for it. It's The Real Story. Subscribe to The Real Story, as I have done. And thanks again.
Well,
And
I hope your viewers and readers do appreciate what you do over there, Bob. You really a tower of strength. The work that you've done is underappreciated in my view. I think you've really on the Chinese interference file, on the Samadun file, you scooped me once, damn it. Is really, really seriously good stuff. So strength to your sword arm and have a happy Christmas, Hanukkah, stuff like that.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, Taiwan influencers bribed by China to promote Chinese Communist Party propaganda. Documentary reveals how United Front Work Department buys off Taiwanese to spread pro-CCP narratives. The 40-minute video features Taiwanese YouTuber Pa Cheung interviewing former pro-CCP influencer and rapper Chen Po-yun. Chen described his experiences working in China, including how the United Front Work Department guided his promotion of pro-CCP narratives. In the New Zealand Herald, Deputy Police Commissioner Devon McSkimming on leave amid investigation, IPCA probe. The second most powerful police officer in New Zealand is on leave pending separate investigations, the Herald can reveal. In 2023, McSkimming was promoted to Deputy Commissioner on the recommendation of Chris Hipkins, who was Prime Minister at the time, following a Public Service Commission selection process. In the Hong Kong Free Press, eyes in the sky, Hong Kong police considering AI-enhanced drone patrols. Secretary for Security Chris Tang, proposing routine drone patrols, said they had already been used for crime detection and investigation, beat patrolling, rescue operations, and firefighting. Authorities will study regulations and standards in other regions, such as mainland China, Australia, and Canada. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In Willamette Week, here are the shakeups hitting diversity, equity, and inclusion offices across Oregon. At least four public agencies in Oregon, three state agencies, and one City of Portland agency have experienced upheavals in their DEI departments. They include the Oregon Health Authority, Portland Parks and Recreation, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, Oregon Department of Forestry, and Oregon Department of Education. In Crosscut, Washington State University unveils newest apple variety name. WA64, a new apple under development through Washington State University's apple breeding program, will be called the Sunflare, the university announced on Tuesday. Wazoo apple breeder Kate Evans announced the name during a session at the annual meeting of the Washington State Tree Fruit Association in Yakima. WA64 is crisper and juicier than Crips Pink, and slightly less crisp and juicy than Honey Crisp. And in the Breaker.News, these headlines this week. Is BC Hydro's future reliant on China? And Richmond councillor denies working for a law firm 2 weeks after he declared a conflict of interest. Read the stories behind these headlines and more. Go to thebreaker.news and Introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone. The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to two organizations that need your help this Christmas time. First, the people at Backpack Buddies, the charity that helps needy children get through weekends with nutritious meals. A $25 donation feeds one child for a full weekend. Go to backpackbuddies.ca. And mark December 17th on your calendar. That's when the Lower Mainland Christmas Bureau's annual Christmas Wish Breakfast happens at the Pan Pacific Hotel in Vancouver. All you have to do is bring an unwrapped toy or cash donation, and you get a free breakfast from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Go to lmcb.ca for more information. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 15th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 15th of December in 1978, President Jimmy Carter said the U.S. would recognize China and sever diplomatic ties with Taiwan? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow the Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support the Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.